and I'm about to share some of it with you. One of the things that I was supposed to do during the first 2 weeks when I was talking is correct something that was in my bio. I'm blaming this on Jamie McAdams because he is not here today to defend himself. But in the bio, it says that I'm like the owner and principal therapist at the Moore Institute, which is not true. And then at the bottom, it says my wife is also a therapist. I was supposed to correct that very early on. Good reason for that, because she's actually the president of the company, owns the company. I work for her. She's also the better therapist of the two. And when I say that she is better half, that is definitely a true statement. Also, the reason that I mention all of that is because I'm going to talk about her just a little bit. She's the person that gives me the most direct and honest feedback, you know, as you might imagine. And I had a meeting with Russell. I was talking to him about where this thing is going, you know, how it's going, where it's going. You know, we started talking about this, and then we decided to have a conversation. Well, okay, now what? And I said, you know, the feedback that Pam gave me last time came right after I was feeling pretty good. I was feeling pretty good at the end of the second session. And she said, you know, it's interesting that the prohibition against talking about this stuff in church is so strong that it's even affecting you. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I saw you pull back. You know, I saw you not say things that you would normally say. I saw you, you know, withhold during the course of your talk last time. And I shared that with Russell, and he immediately said, well, that makes me a little nervous about what else she might say. Also good feedback. During that conversation too, I did this thing that people must do to preachers all the time, which I started talking to him about theology and something I thought, you know. And that, but he didn't complain about this at all. But it must happen to preachers all the time, you know. This is what I think about it all. And so I started talking to him about this idea that I had about omnipotence and how I was going to work it into the conversation toward the end. And so I'm talking, he's listening patient to me talk about this omnipotence idea. And at the end of it, he looks at me and says, all that omnipotence thing is all right with me if you'll just stop talking about impotence. And I was not going to talk about it anymore, right up until that moment. You know, we sort of used that example, you know, the erectile dysfunction, you know, example early on, just to talk about how our belief systems affect things. And so I do want to talk about that some more, just belief systems, our understanding about things. As we try to talk about depression, instead of talking about omnipotence, I'm going to talk about something easier. I'm going to talk about sin. So that's not something I'm an expert in. I'm an expert in sinning, but not an expert in knowing about sin. But you know, some of the definitions I've heard in the past that made some sense to me went like this. Sin is anything that separates me from the sunlight of the Spirit and the love of God. I heard that before, and that sort of made sense to me, and I like that. It's not the definition we use most of the time in our own lives, I don't think. Most of the time, I mean something that I'm doing wrong, that I know is wrong, that I could do differently if I chose to. That's the way that I use it most of the time, is doing wrong. You know, it's like something that I'm doing wrong that I know, and I could be doing better too. And so I want to think about that when I ask you these questions. Is unhappiness a sin? Is depression a sin? How about fear? Is fear a sin? She read that it was last time. Is anxiety a sin? Is killing myself a sin? Now, I don't propose to answer any of these questions for you today. They're really important. But it goes to how I think about things. It goes to how I think about what is wrong with people. And remember at the beginning of this, I said what I believe is wrong determines how I treat that person. What I believe is wrong with them, what I believe makes them be the way that they are, that determines how I treat you. It determines how I treat you as an individual, as a culture, as a society, as a church. It determines how we treat people. And if we believe that people could be doing what we choose to, that's going to determine a lot about how we treat them, isn't it? And you know, we have a big bias in our society toward this idea of happiness and toward the idea of not having fear in our life, don't we? I mean, I'm not an expert in the Bible, but there's a whole lot of fear not in the Bible, isn't there? And there are like a whole lot of bias toward fear not, and maybe if you have a certain amount of faith, then you don't have fear. That's the way I ended up with it. Maybe it's not really there, but that's kind of how I ended up with it. And there sure is a whole lot of rejoicing, isn't there? You know, there's a whole lot of idea about that we shouldn't be afraid if we were doing this thing right, and we should be rejoicing. And I ended up with sort of a bias toward the idea that if I was doing this Christian thing right, that I would be rejoicing and I wouldn't be afraid. That's where I ended up at. And I was doing something wrong if I wasn't rejoicing and if I was, in fact, afraid. And that's problematic for me. So it turns out that, as you might imagine, there's some depression in the Bible. You know, here's an example. Here's some things. Now, this, I actually found a list of examples of people who had depression in the Bible. Now, we can't diagnose depression from across the room. I don't know how we can diagnose it millenniums in the past, but here's what this says. It says Abraham, Jonah, Job, Elijah, King Saul, Jeremiah, and David. And I thought, well, how do they know that? How can they possibly say that all of these people were depressed? And then, I mean, if somebody named Jeremiah actually wrote this, here's what he wrote. Cursed be the day on which I was born. The day when my mother bore me, let it not be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, a son has bore thee. Why did I come out of the womb to see toil and sorrow and spend my days in shame? I got to tell you, that sounds depressing. I mean, it really does. You know, in David, the verse that's attributed, the one that we all quote the most, that's supposed to be the most comforting psalm, is the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, right? That's Psalm 23, and it's the most often quoted psalm, probably, about comforting and feeling happy and stuff like that. I'm more interested in Psalm 22. You know what it says? My God, why have you forsaken me? Right? And then it follows up with something along the lines of, and why are you so far from my words of my distress, my cries for help? I cry by day and by night, but you do not answer. And in my sleep there is no rest. That's what Psalm 22 says just before we get to Psalm 23. Sounds depressed, doesn't it? Sounds depressed. Still, I get a lot of bias in my own Christian life and my own training and upbringing, the idea that I'm really supposed to be pretty happy. That's supposed to be what's happening with me. And what about in Western culture and in Western thinking? Don't we have a lot of bias toward happy? Because I'm happy, right? I mean, aren't we supposed to be happy? Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing? We are really prejudiced in the Western society and Western culture toward the idea that happy is what we are supposed to be and what we're supposed to be accomplishing. Certainly in America, we pursue happiness with a vengeance. I mean, we're really intent about that that's what we're supposed to be doing. But if that really what life is, that somehow or another, if I'm doing it right, the end result of that is supposed to be my own personal happiness, is that what I'm supposed to end up with? Everybody in America today, somehow or another, believes that they're supposed to be cool, calm, and collected. And that is a deodorant commercial from the 60s. It really is. Secret, I think. It was a deodorant commercial from the 1960s, and we bought it. Not only the deodorant, we bought the concept that we're all supposed to be cool, calm, and collected. We're not supposed to be anxious, and by golly, we're supposed to be happy. I don't know. When we ended up with these prejudices, we discarded a whole lot of things that I think were important for us to normalize, and one of those is mood. You know, that moods change. I mean, really, my mood can change on whim. Just little things can change it. I felt better when I looked out and saw the sunshine, didn't you? I mean, and that changes my mood. If the sun goes in here in a minute, that's going to change my mood. You know, my mood goes up and down with all kinds of things. And really, I think that's part of being alive, isn't it? That some of us are moodier than others. And probably that's innate. We think that that's probably born into us, is that the reality is that some of us are more moody than others. Some of us have more ups and downs than others. And that's probably not that big a deal. What about sadness? Am I not supposed to experience the thing that we call grief or sadness when I lose something that's important to me? how much exactly grief am I supposed to experience when I lose somebody that I love? Society seems to tell us that the idea is about 3 days bereavement, right? 3 days bereavement is what you're going to get, and then you're supposed to be over it. How quickly should you be over it when you lose someone that you love? When should I stop grieving? When does it become pathological? What is the difference between these things? The same question comes up about fear. If I'm never supposed to be afraid, how does that actually make any sense? There's a strong argument in psychology today that we are alive as a species because we are so fearful, that it's an evolutionary positive for us to be so fearful, that the reason that we survive is because we're scared, you know? And we're looking out for things that might go wrong or something bad that might happen, and we're always looking for what might be going wrong. And that's the reason we survived as a species. And that a species that possesses no fear is probably extinct, right? And the reason that we made it is because we're a very fearful species. And so it's an evolutionary positive that we have so much fear in our lives, and yet today, none of us actually want to be experiencing fear. Do you know that they make motorcycle helmets emblazoned with the words "no fear" on them? Do you really think that's a good idea? I'm pretty sure that you ought to be fearful if you ride a motorcycle, or at least watchful, or at least careful. I'm pretty sure that there shouldn't be no fear. Maybe we need more courage, which is, of course, feeling afraid and doing it anyway, right? Perhaps I need to be braver, but I'm not sure that it's a good idea that we never experience fear. The manifestations of these things, if we would agree for a moment that sadness and grief and fear are a normal part of life, and there are things that are going to happen to each and every one of us, the manifestations of those things are the physical parts of what goes on when I experience them. And the thing that we feel when we feel fear is anxiety, right? So anxiety is the physical manifestation of fear. And everybody gets it. I don't know what yours is. You know, is it sweaty palms? Is it flip-flops in your stomach? Is it shaky? I mean, almost always the anxiety thing is a moving thing. We got a lot of movement going on, right? We got a lot of movement in our bodies. A lot of shaking, a lot of jumping. And almost always the physical manifestation of the thing that we call sadness is a heaviness, right? Heaviness in my chest, down, right? Downhearted, burden. You know, some of the language that we use, all of that language came from somewhere, right? And it turns out that there's some pretty reliable physical signs that the sadness that we experience is sort of a triangle, right? I experience it in these areas, lump in my throat, right? And that fear is a triangle that extends all the way down in this direction, and it's moving, belly and knees. And see, what I'm arguing to you is that one of the things that our prejudices about these things have led us to is thinking that somehow or another I should not be experiencing those things. I don't think that's safe. I don't think it's sane. As a matter of fact, if there's something scary happening, I really do believe that fear and anxiety is the natural and normal reaction to those things. And that all of us should have the expectation that we will experience these things. I read an author one time who said that the modern age has created anxiety in two different ways. One is because we stand at a crossroads. On the one hand, what we have is total despair and lack of hope, and on the other hand, we have total annihilation and extinction, and we pray for the wisdom to choose correctly between the two. Because it seems that in modern society, there's very little choice left in the direction that things are headed. And that leads us to a sort of a learned helplessness that we all experience together, which is that there's not much way that I can affect what's happening in the world. You know, there's just not much way that I can make it better. And there's not much way that me personally, that I'm able to do anything. And because of that, it creates a fair level of fear and anxiety in all of us that all of us have to live with. And I'm arguing that that's normal. That level of fear and anxiety is normal. I also know that there's no way to get through this life without experiencing loss. We're not going to make it through it without experiencing loss. If I love, I will lose. And to the extent that I do love, I will lose more. The greater my love in this life, the greater my loss will be in this life. Isn't that true? The more I love, the more I have at stake, and the more I have in the game. So my only choice is to try to have less in the game, that is, love less, so I experience less grief and loss, or to accept the reality that I'm going to experience that. So see, I say all of this at the beginning because I want us to normalize the feelings that we have and say to ourselves, this is part of being alive. Happy, sad, angry, afraid, this is part of being alive, to have all of these things going on in my life. It's part of who I am, and we have acceptance of these things and don't need to change them. Now, when we move into the area of mental health then, what we want to do is we want to say, well, okay, at what point does this become a thing that we call disorder or clinical? At what point do we say that this is not normal anymore? Well, you know, you got to know in our business, that's really hard to do. But we've tried. A lot of people that are smarter than me have tried to think about it. And for good or ill, what we've done is we've turned it into a medical model of thinking. Antibiotics did this to us. Antibiotics really ruined medicine and helped medicine all at the same time, right? Because it kind of took the art out of it, and what it said was, here you have this thing, it's a bad thing that hurts the body, we take this thing, it fixes it and makes it better. And we all grew up with the notion that when you get sick, you go to the doctor gives you a prescription to make it better, and that's what we do, right? That's the idea that we all grew up with, and by golly, we love that notion. Love that notion in America. We really did. And so we tried to medicalize psychiatry and psychology and the understanding of people and what goes wrong with people. And what that caused us to do is to make all these categories to try to understand things like depression, anxiety, to see if we could figure out at what point it's disordered and at what point we should be treating it. Well, here's the first problem with that. The idea that depression is a discrete thing that's completely separate from anxiety is probably not true. Or that anxiety is a discrete and separate thing, completely separate from depression, probably not true. But when you create these categories and give them names and stuff, it sort of creates the illusion that it is true. But I really have never met a depressed person yet who didn't have some anxiety, usually a lot. And I've really never met an anxious person yet who didn't have depression. So the idea that these are like sort of separate and discrete entities that we can treat according to the antibiotic model, probably not the case. Still, the science that it gave us some good ways to think about helping people at a point at which it no longer seems normal to them. Right? So here's the point at which there's a lot of ways that we think about this, but here's the easy way to think about it. We believe that anxiety and depression become disordered at the point at which there is no longer a cause and effect that we can see. So for instance, if the sun is up and everything's going great, and that's a thing that normally I would feel relatively uplifted about, and yet I do not today, and the next day, and the next day, maybe then. If my dog dies and I'm sad, that's sad. If nothing has happened and I'm sad, maybe not, right? So there's a point at which there is no cause and effect. So the big thing that we have when we start to think of things in terms of disorder is there is no cause that makes sense to the person or to anybody else that we tell it to. So I'm feeling much more anxious than the situation makes sense to me or to anyone else. And it persists for a long enough period of time that it causes me dysfunction in my life. Now that's the way that we try to think about it. We try to think about, does it have cause and does it persist over time? At that point, we start to talk about it in terms of disorder. We talk about it in terms of something maybe that we should look at and think about if there's a way to fix it, if there's something that we can do about it. I don't know if that helps us very much because too much is a question that I asked earlier that we don't necessarily know the answer to. There's two times a year that I experience sadness about the death of my mother, which is now 34 years ago. You know, there's two times a year that it happens to me, and it's around the time that she was dying, when I was relatively younger, and it's around the holidays at Christmas time, and it happens to me pretty consistently. I don't call that depression. I've said it before, I've said I was depressed, but I don't think that is, because there's a cause, right? And I guess somebody could look at me and say, well, Steve, it's been 34 years. Should you really still feel sad about that around that time? I go, well, I think so. It seems like to me that I should. It seems like I should. So the persistence and the length is tricky. So a lot of it has to do with how you experience your daily life. In my opinion, we too quickly rush to try to fix the thing that we call sadness because of our prejudice about it. In my opinion, we too quickly try to stop people from experiencing what I would consider to be normal sadness that's associated with losses in their life. The thing we call depression, a couple of people have talked about it in different ways that were helpful to me. I read that the Dalai Lama wrote about it and called it prolonged discouragement. I liked that, prolonged discouragement. Then there's a guy named Father Joseph Martin, now gone, who was kind of famous in my field, who said that he believed that frozen anger turned inward. I don't really know what to make of these things, except for it helps me to think about it in different ways, other than the models that we use now, which are primarily biological. Man, I gotta tell you, in my business, they're making some amazing advances in the way that we think about stuff, and the ways that we think about brain and brain chemistry and all that kind of stuff. Here's the scary thing that I've told you about before. It's just stunning to me how often we are wrong. It's just amazing to me how often, I mean, just look at medicine. Take a look at the stuff that we thought 10 years ago we were absolutely sure that we were right, and now no longer think so. You don't have to go back very far to find a whole long list of things that we go, not so sure we're right about that. Yeah, pretty soon there's going to be some, you know, major tort cases, you know, based on that. Because we just turns out that we were wrong about it. And boy, nowhere is that more true in this thing that we call psychiatry. You know, let me go back just 100 years and give you a little thing here. Used to, you could get committed to institutions relatively easily. So Pam went to the trouble to find something, I think this is around 100 years old, of when the things that you could be committed to an asylum, they were called lunatic asylums then, no longer. And here's just a few things off the list that I found were interesting. This is the one, mental excitement. Do too much mental excitement, you could definitely, overtaxing mental powers. I'm not sure what that means. Bad company. Bad whiskey. And domestic affliction. Here's the way that you know men were in charge. Hysteria. And imaginary female trouble. You could also get committed for woman trouble, superstition, and here's my favorite, religious enthusiasm. We maybe shouldn't have given that one up. Because it turns out that among Christians, among people who call themselves fundamentalists, more than 50% will say in a survey that they believe that the only answer to the problems that we're talking about today is reading the Bible and prayer. More than 50% will say that the only solution is reading the Bible and prayer. That I could write off, because I tend to write those people off in my head a lot. But then it said 30% of all Americans agree with that statement. 30% of all Americans. I don't know where Episcopalians fit in there, but 30% of all Americans said that. The idea being that somehow or another, what I should be doing is doing better, right? If I was doing better, then I wouldn't be having the signs and symptoms that we're talking about. It's a pretty dangerous notion to me, because it doesn't allow me to be very helpful to people. So what does help? If we have these things that are called depression and anxiety, and let's assume that we knew where the line was and assume that we knew what we can do about it, what does help? Well, it turns out that we've discovered a fair amount of things that really do help. Of the things that go wrong with people psychologically or psychiatrically, depression and anxiety are the two things that we're absolutely the best at helping with. They're the things that we can make the most difference in. Anxiety, as it turns out, very, very open to therapy. And we have a whole lot of different ways that we can help with that and a whole lot of different things that we can do. And yet, very few people seek out therapy for anxiety. Same thing is true for depression. We pass out lots of depression in America today. Started with Prozac with the most, and now we have a whole lot more different kinds. Some of them are good, some of them help some people some of the time, but what all research shows is that in conjunction with talk therapy helps the best. All research shows that, and yet what most people do is see a physician and get a prescription, start taking that prescription, and don't ever engage in the thing that we call talk therapy. It's not a good idea. I mean, it's less effective. The better thing for us to do is to talk with one another together. So here's what I want you to know. I want you to know what this area of depression and suicide, a bias toward happy, has hurt us. And we're almost always wrong about that. Some of you may have heard of a book written by a guy named Daniel Gilbert called Stumbling on Happiness. This is a fascinating book in which he lays out in detail the thing that almost all of us already know intuitively, and that is we have no idea what will make us happy. We don't know. How are we supposed to pursue it? We don't know. Because we're consistently wrong about it. He deals into detail in this book about the statistics about acquiring money. Because all of us believe if we would acquire more money somehow or another, that would make us happy. We're consistently wrong about that. Just wrong about that. Bad things happening to us in the future. We all believe that that will make us unhappy. Here's the bad things that would happen to me that I'm sure if it happened, it would make me unhappy in the future. It turns out that for the most part, we're just wrong about that. He goes into great detail in this book to show the statistics that prove what we all really already know is a lot of the things that we fear the most didn't hurt us as much as they thought they were going to. A lot of the things we wanted the most didn't make us happier or make us feel better. Yeah? We all kind of know that, don't we? Boy, it doesn't keep us from trying to keep bad things from happening, trying to get more money, though, does it? It really doesn't. Yet it's true. What he said, and this is the title of the book, when you do find happiness, it's what you stumble over as you're walking blindly forward trying to find the thing that you think will make you happy. You kind of trip over it along the way. And that's how you find things. Huh. I think it's definitely true. So we have to end our bias toward happiness and our belief that somehow or another, if we pursue it, we will find it. And we have to end our bias against moodiness, against unhappiness, against sadness, and against fear. And instead, we have to be able to talk to each other about the reality that we're probably experiencing those things. Statistics show us that 50% of us will experience the thing that's called clinical depression in our lifetime. Half of us. Half of us are going to experience the thing that meets the clinical criteria at some point in our lifetime. For most of us, what will happen is we will get through it somehow. All of us in our lifetime, all of us will experience anxiety to the point that it's called disorder. All of us will. And we will get through it for the most part. For those of us who are struggling to get through it, we have got to be able to ask for help, and it's got to be okay for us to. I was just talking with somebody in the choir this morning because he had been thinking about some of the things that we were saying, and he just said to me this morning, you know, why is it that when you're in the hospital for your appendix or something like that, you can call up there and get some information? What room is the person in, you know, that kind of stuff. But when you're in the hospital for a psychiatric, you can't. I mean, you can't find out anything about it. He was just wondering. Why is that true? So it's absolutely the stigma. Absolutely the reason for it. We're protecting people from the stigma that's associated with this. We're protecting people from stigma. We could just change our minds about that, right? We could. we can just decide that there's no more stigma associated with having a persistent anxiety or a persistent depression that needed attention, we could just change our minds about that. And here's the thing that I want you to know. Most of us get better. Most of us get better. You know, for the most part, we're really good at helping with this stuff. Which leads me to our discussion about suicide. Man, this is a hard topic. I gotta tell you, it's hard to talk about for a whole bunch of different reasons. The statistics are rough. When we start talking about the incidence of suicide of people killing themselves in America today, it's pretty tough. One thing that you should know is that the overall number of people who commit suicide, for the most part, is relatively consistent. It goes up and down a little bit, but it's not a dramatic increase that we're seeing right now, except for in subgroups. That's interesting, that groups of people commit suicide at different rates at different times. That's interesting to me. But the most profound thing is that we believe that suicide is contagious. We believe that somehow or another, in ways that we don't understand completely, that if people commit suicide and we find out about it, if I know about suicide and I strongly relate to that person, that increases my chances of suicide. That's why we tend to see clusters of things happening. I read that after Marilyn Monroe's suicide, that the rate of suicide went up 12% over time in young women. Because of the idea that there was a relationship there. You know? There's also this idea that somehow or another there's a permission thing that's associated with it. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if that's true or not, but the idea that the more we talk about a thing, the more likely a person is to bring something from the back of their mind to the front of their mind. And that it creates a permission in my head, right? And that's one of the ideas that we're playing around with about all kinds of violence and problems that we see in the world. Because we know about everything. By golly, if it happens, you see it, right? On the internet, on television, we see it. We know about it. Is that somehow or another, is that causing us to feel more permissive about things? Not a permissive society, but permission to behave in certain ways? Now, we don't know that for sure. I'll tell you one thing that definitely has not worked. What has not reduced the suicide rate at all is telling people they're going to go to hell. That apparently has not done it, right? To tell people that that's going to be the end result has not helped. The other thing that hasn't helped is the notion from the Enlightenment and forward that somehow or another it's a matter of personal choice, that somehow or another it's your right to do so. None of these things seem to have been very helpful as we go forward. The thing that seems to be the most helpful is that in interpersonal relationships with other human beings that I am able to talk to you about. We have a hard time knowing, of course, why people who do commit suicide do. We're only able to talk to people who try and do not end up dead. You know, we're able to talk to those folks. And so we understand some things poorly. The thing that I'm told the most about people who are feeling suicidal is, I could not do that to the people who love me, whoever that may be. The problem I have with saying that out loud is, it doesn't explain the people who have committed suicide who have people who love them. And I don't understand what the difference is. I wish I could tell you. You know, I wish I had an answer for that. I don't. I don't understand why some of us are still here and some are not in this situation. I know that if a person is feeling despondent over a long enough period of time, that oftentimes they begin to have thoughts. Do you know what percentage of people will have thoughts of taking their own life? It's significant. It's a big percentage of people that actually have thoughts of taking their own life. We feel ashamed to say that out loud. We believe that earlier intervention, that talking about it earlier on with another caring individual, is a positive thing. We believe that the more we are able to not be ashamed and to speak out loud with one another, the more positive that will be. In church, we have a definite prejudice toward not talking about this, don't we? We have a definite prejudice toward not talking about this. It's my hope that that's one of the things that we can change together, is that I don't have to be afraid. Pam says I already told this story, I'm going to tell it to you anyway. A few years ago, 20, okay, 25 years ago, somewhere around in there. I went to a Sunday school class. I was going through a period where I was believing in honesty and telling the truth. It was a phase that I went through. In the Sunday school class, which was for couples, the very earnest teacher stood up and said, you know, we're going to talk to each other honestly, and we're going to tell the truth about the things that we struggle with, so that we can deal with them together. That's the way it's supposed to work. I'm pretty sure it's in Bible verses that prove that that was true, that that's the way Christianity was supposed to work. And so I volunteered, and I said, I struggle with lying. I said, I am a threat to lie to you, especially if I'm trying to control what you think about me. If I'm worried about whether or not you like me or not, I will lie to you. I felt pretty good about it, you know, after I said that. There was not anything else said in the Sunday school class. Because we don't like to talk about anything being wrong with us, do we? We don't. We don't like to talk about it. I'm supposed to be not afraid, especially if I have enough faith. I'm supposed to be rejoicing. I just don't always. You know, I just don't always. Sometimes I'm depressed and sometimes I'm anxious, you know? We have to be able to say these things to each other in love. I don't know about this thing about hating the sin but loving the sinner. Confusing to me when I hear people say stuff like that. Here's the prejudice that I'm trying to develop in myself, and I'm going to offer it to you. I believe that you are doing the best that you can. And if you could be doing better, you would be. I choose to believe that with whatever's going on with you right now, you are doing the best that you can. And if you could be doing better, you would be. Thanks for listening, y'all.